in here too.
Welcome. ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac David McKelvin,
and myself, Ryan White. Thanks for joining us today. In studio, we have the Love Doctor, Sean Weber.
Welcome back.
Yes, welcome back. Second time, Sean.
How'd I get the title, the Love Doctor?
Well, I gave it to you.
Oh, okay. Well, then that makes it good. Yes. Glad to be here.
He is a family law attorney with Brave, Weber, and Mac. He's got a great segment on his website called Love and Real Estate. Website, again, bravewebermac.com. We're going to go through some of those topics for you. Is an advocate of the collaborative divorce and has a really good track record of being able to keep people out of court, which I think we all want to avoid when going through a divorce.
And also, I think it was, we were talking earlier about that nesting thing where people get a divorce, but the kids stay at the house and the parents leave. Seems like a very interesting concept.
Yeah, it's a great way to do things if you can make it work, because put the kids first, let them have the house, and you pack up your bags and move in and out of the house.
Well, I mean, imagine if you lived, 15, 20 minutes away, and you've got to take the kids to school and back, and there's all this moving around. I mean, I don't know. The only thing I think would get in the way would be the wife's closet. I mean, how do you get around that one?
That could certainly be an issue.
Also on the show, Chris McBrearty, loan officer with the lending company and an active property flipper. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you.
Good to have you guys here today. We are going to go, as David said, we will touch on nesting a little bit. Sean's going to walk us through his ebook, what I'm going to call What's Love Got to Do with It. It says Personal Guide to Owning Real Estate and Being in a Relationship. He's got a couple points to touch on there. We're going to hit a few of those. We're going to talk about a deferred sale, touch on collaborative divorce. Really a hot topic now is how to beat a cash buyer. Chris has a couple topics.
That is a hot topic right now with the shortage of inventory and all these FHA buyers out there right now. Chris, you got some great information for us today about that and some ways to get around some of the obstacles that we're seeing in the marketplace to make a not cash offer pretty close to the same thing.
Fact is, about half of the transactions today are still government financing, either FHA or VA, with the vast majority of those being FHA. The best thing you can do is to turn your FHA buyer into someone who looks like a cash buyer or resembles as much of a cash buyer as possible.
We're also going to talk about the real estate mojo and how when you get the mojo, it can save you thousands of dollars.
Absolutely. Pull on those heartstrings of the ownership of that property and you can help your buyers get in.
Chris has got a loan that requires only 0.5% down. That's right.
0.5%
down. And some discussion about lending below 640 as a credit score. So we got that in front of us. And before we really get into this with Sean, I'd like to open up by, Chris, what's the going rate today?
Going rate today? That's a very open-ended question.
That's right, it is.
Completely depends on the type of product that you're looking at, if you're FHA, VA, or conventional financing. Also depends on your credit score, how much money you're putting down, and the size of the loan that you're doing.
Okay, let's do this. 30-year fixed, 417, 20% down, 740 credit score, W-2 employee. What's the going rate?
You're going to be at 3.25 or less.
Thank you.
Three and a quarter or less, right?
Three
pull out all the stop signs, huh, Ryan?
Yeah, I don't know stop signs.
Thanks for the disclosures there, McBearty.
3.25 or less. So if you have an interest rate above 3 and...
I would say 3.875, you need to be calling me and talking to me about a refinance.
Got it. So if you don't have a rate in the threes right now, it's time to start thinking about refinancing.
It's not only time to start thinking, it's time to pick up that phone. It's very important for your financial future to have a look at that. You could be saving tens or even hundreds of thousands over the life of your loan.
We will definitely touch on that.
If your rate is over 3.875, call me at 888-551-2593. I mean, this is what I do. I appraise property all the time. And if you're just curious about what the value of your home is to see if your loan-to-value ratios will qualify for a refinance, give us a call. We'd love to share with you what the value is based on the historical data in the MLS that we find.
All right, Sean, this guide to being a single person and owning real estate. How did this all come about?
Well, I get asked questions as an attorney. People ask me questions. And so that's how we got the guide, is because people kept asking me questions about what they do with their house, what do they do with their real estate needs, what do they do if they're going to get married and they've got a house, what do they do if they're getting divorced and they've got a house, or they've got other multiple properties, what's going to be my community property, what's going to be my separate property. And so that's pretty much where the guide came from, is just me attempting to answer some of my clients' questions.
So it sounds like, yeah, it sounds like this is a compilation of all the questions people have paid to ask you. Essentially, you're giving away for free.
That's right.
That's nice to hear. You just, that you just email it over?
Yeah,
we
send an email. We'll put an email form. All you got to do is get a hold of us at the show. There's a list that we're going to go through, just a few of them. And let's start with just one or two here in the beginning.
Sure.
So if I own the property before we get married and we break up, what happens?
Okay, and we're married? Is that the question?
Yes. If I own it before I own the property,
prior to
we
the marriage.
Get married.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What happens to the house?
Okay, so it's important at this point to have a real quick primer on what is community property and what is separate property, okay? Community property is any property that is acquired during the marriage. It's split 50-50 with some exceptions. If you think of it as terms of goalposts, we're on ESPN Radio, right? So if you have date of marriage on one side and date of separation on the other side, if you get it between the goalposts, it's community property. But what happens a lot of times is people will purchase things prior to the marriage, and that'll be separate property. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people are worried, what happens to this house that I owned before we got married? If we get, if we split up, does that mean it's community property? Does that mean she gets half? And the answer is no, as long as you're careful, okay? And there's some things you can do to what's called transmute the property. It's called transmutation, not to be confused with transubstantiation.
Of course not.
But what that means is
right.
Yeah, you're laughing there.
Right,
good.
Right,
yeah,
right.
You're
got
slow,
but
you gotta love attorneys.
You gotta love that one.
Now that I've offended every Catholic in the audience. The point is, with transmutation, you can do things that will convert your separate property to community property. So one thing you want to be careful about doing is say you're married and you're paying for the mortgage out of your wages. Anytime you have a principal reduction, that's going to create a community property interest in your separate property.
Every time you have a principal reduction.
Right. So you pay your mortgage and it reduces the principal. Now you've got the community property just bought some interest in your separate property house.
Right.
The other thing that can happen is, maybe you're doing a refi or something like that, and you execute a deed to, because the lender wants it in joint name or some for some reason. Well, that deed's a very powerful instrument. You've just now transmuted that document. Or you've transmuted that house, and have now created community property. Now, there's some rules, where we can fight these things in court. You can say, look, I signed that deed, but I didn't really mean it was going to be a transmutation.
Well, that's going to be pretty tough to say that you didn't really mean to make him or her as part of the property. But what you touched on is if you're paying the mortgage out of money that perhaps you both make and is paying down the principal, which most loans are, it now has some gray area of being community property.
Correct. And I don't care whether it's your wages or her wages. If you earn it during the community, remember it got through the goalposts.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you earned it during the marriage, that's community property. And you've now, and that's most people. Most people, you can't just pay from a separate source the mortgage on a property. You're going to have to pay your mortgage. So little by little, you're going to be eking into your separate property interest with this community
Unless
property.
I owned it.
Exactly. That makes sense.
Maybe I owned it free and clear, didn't have a mortgage, possibly.
That's what I wanted to ask. So if you came into the marriage owning property free and clear, nothing in writing, no agreements beforehand, 10 years down the line,
it's yours.
A couple decides it doesn't work out.
It's yours. And say you have a rental, okay, and you're getting rental income. That rental income is now your separate property. Even though it's earned during the marriage, it's your separate property because it came from the separate property source, which was the piece of real estate.
And isn't inheritance also follow under this guideline?
Right. The exception to the community property rule is anything by bequest, inheritance, or devise, or gift.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if I give you a gift of a house, or you get a gift from Aunt Mabel or something like that, that's your separate property as long as you don't transmute it.
So is there a way that I can own a house ahead of time with a mortgage on it, most common situation, get married and not have to give? Is there a way I can pay for the home without community money? It doesn't sound like there is.
Well, unless you don't use community property to pay for it. So what a lot of people do, they have rentals. Sometimes these rentals are self-supporting.
Let's say it's primary residence.
It's primary residence. Then you're probably going to have an interest, unless you got an interest-only loan. If you're paying interest-only payments, then you're not going to have a principal reduction.
Oh, okay, so it's only the principal reduction. That's interesting. Okay.
Yep.
Okay, got it. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, I see that. Well, so we're going to drop. So that's the idea, I guess. Make your payments only interest only, or to the extent you've paid down principal, that's the portion that would be considered community property.
Yeah, or just be okay with it. You know,
or just be okay
just
with
kind
it.
Of understand that's the state.
It's hard
of the
not
law.
To when you're married, right? I mean, that's part
it's
of
part
the,
of it.
It's part of marriage, or you can get a prenup. You know, that's a whole other discussion.
It's a whole other discussion. We're going to have Tiffany Hazelar on the show, Dedicated Credit Repair. She's going to walk us through the credit repair Mythbusters tip of the week. And the next question here on your list is, how long do we have to be married before the spouse is entitled to half of my stuff? Sean is going to answer that question for us all when we come back. Welcome back, 1700 AM, ESPN Radio. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac David McKelvin here.
And myself, Ryan White, in studio with us, the love doctor, Sean Weber, enlightening us about love and real estate. Also, Christopher McBrearty, loan officer extraordinaire with the lending company, is going to tell us how we can get a loan for only 0.5% down. Thank you guys for joining
also
us.
We're going to talk about the real estate mojo and how that can save you thousands of dollars when you're writing an offer on a property.
Before we went to break, we were talking about your love and real estate guide. And last question here. Tiffany, are you there?
I am.
Okay,
hi, how are you?
Great, Tiffany. How you doing? Thank you.
I'm doing good.
Dedicated Credit Repair, Tiffany Hazelar. Do you have our credit repair tip of the week, Tiffany?
I absolutely do, and this week it is all about dealing with collections, collection accounts that may appear either on a credit report, or perhaps you've received a phone call from a creditor or a letter that states that you basically owe a collection debt that maybe you did or did not know that you owned. The very first option you have, of course, is to settle that debt. Usually 25 to 50 cents on the dollar is a good settlement. But what people don't always realize is that they also have the option for debt validation. And a debt validation was established basically so that the collection agencies cannot illegally try to collect a debt that doesn't belong to them. So essentially, it's a legal procedure, which is spelled out clearly by the FDCPA, Fair Debt Collections Practices Act. It does not cover collection tactics of the original creditor, like, say, for example, the credit card company itself. It only governs the actions of debt collectors. But since most debt gets sold to collection agencies, it's actually a very common approach to having something removed off of a credit report.
Seems like a unique approach. And actually, this is something that you guys do?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We definitely help perform those for clients. Basically, the collection company has to provide proof that the collection, that they own the collection debt. At a minimum, they have to provide some sort of account statement from the original creditor. And sometimes we can even actually ask or request that they provide complete payment history from the original creditor, which is often hard to do, and or the signed copy of the loan agreement by the credit card applicant.
Are you still giving away free enrollment in Dedicated Credit Repair's Easy Pay system? You still doing that, Tiffany?
Absolutely.
The helpline, 888-551-2593. Again, 888-551-2593. That's the number. Leave a message. Tiffany will call you back, get you free enrollment in Dedicated Credit Repair's Easy Pay system, and get your, debts removed. Thank you, Tiffany.
Thank you.
All right, Sean, kind of stepped on myself here. Let's go back to this question.
Okay.
How long do we have to be married before the spouse is entitled to half of my stuff?
Okay, so this is a trick question. So we go back to the goalposts argument that we were talking about before.
Okay.
Date of marriage on one side, date of separation on the other side, that's how you get community property. Okay. That's the only way you get community property. Okay, so the length of the marriage doesn't really matter. If you have separate property, like we were talking about with the house before, if you have separate property, you come into the marriage, the length of the marriage isn't going to, like, I was married for 20 years versus I was married to 10 years, so therefore she gets more of it. That's not how it works. It's just, was this asset acquired during the marriage, and is it now therefore community property?
Well, doesn't long-term and short-term marriage come into play? But that comes into play when you're talking about alimony.
Right. That's about alimony, and you know, which is also spousal support mm-hmm. under the family code. And
what are those time frames for that?
Well, you know, the kind of the bright line rule of thumb, it's not necessarily a rule of thumb in the code, but it's one that we're following, and it's mentioned in the code, but it's not you know, Karns aren't stuck with it. It's 10 years. So if you have a marriage of 10 years or longer, you have what's called a marriage of long duration. And all that means is that the court probably won't set a termination date for spousal support. So in essence, you could
so
maybe
could
be paying spousal support forever.
Yeah. Forever and ever.
So would the reverse be true then for debts acquired? And
yes.
Okay.
Your question is, are debts that are acquired during the marriage, are those now community debts versus debts that are acquired outside of the goalposts?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, if they're acquired after the day of separation, for instance, prior to the divorce being finalized, those are separate property debts.
Okay.
We are on with Sean Weber of Brave, Weber, and Mac. He's a family law attorney here in Solana Beach, going through his guide to being a single person and owning real estate. If you have any questions, 888-551-2593, 888-551-2593. This stuff is a little bit complicated, but Sean is going to be hanging around after the show, answer any questions people might have, and basically is here to help.
Yeah, you know, Sean, I've got a question for you in terms of, you know, acquiring your real estate when you're still married. It's within that goalpost. I mean, so you acquire property 2 weeks before you get a divorce because you're wanting to leap out and get your own place and set up your own life and move on. Is she still entitled to that? I mean, do you need to record after the marriage settlement agreement is agreed upon, you're officially divorced?
Yeah, the recording date isn't nearly as important as what assets were used to acquire the piece of real estate. You know, if you say you're getting divorced and you purchase a property during the separation period, it's probably a good rule of thumb to go ahead and get a quitclaim deed from her at the time of purchase, just mm-hmm. to make sure that everyone's clear that mm-hmm. this is your separate asset mm-hmm. and that you're acquiring it with separate property funds. If you acquired it just before the date of separation, you know, that can be a gray area. And, yeah, that would technically be a community property house even if 2 days before the date of separation. Mm-hmm. But here's the reality. What's the equity in that house? If you just bought it, it's not going to have a whole bunch of equity in it.
Right.
Well, I mean, if it does, it's probably that you took money from commingled assets and acquired that property, which is community property.
Right, and the community would be entitled to a reimbursement.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. If you bought a house a week or two before you were legally divorced, I mean, it seems like that would still constitute the same problem. What if we're legally married but haven't seen each other in years and I want to buy with someone else? Still stuck?
You can be. I mean, you might be able to determine a date of separation. That's a term of art in the family code, and it's basically the date that both of you knew that the marriage was irretrievably broken.
You know, Sean, I've got a question because we're seeing some of this out there. I mean, with the real estate economy the way that it's been, you know, we hear of people that are going their separate ways, but they're staying in the same house or they're living in the same house, and they're actually choosing not to get a divorce because they can't afford it. Are you seeing this change, or what are the trends that you're seeing right now?
That's a very good point that you're making. Right after 2008, we saw a whole lot of people in that situation where they were just kind of holding on because they didn't know what was going to happen. You know, everything was kind of crazy. People were upside down in their houses, and so they were just kind of hunkering down, and they're putting up with the marriage that really needed to end. And what I've seen is there has been some pent-up demand, if you will, for lack of a better term, for people really, you know, they get to a point where they really do need to do something about the marriage, and so now they're starting to, as things are stabilizing, they're starting to.
So now that things
more,
are,
I'm seeing more filings. I don't know if that's a trend.
Things have recovered a little bit, so therefore people are feeling more comfortable about making that decision.
Yeah, you know, the more money people make, sometimes it seems counterintuitive, but the more money people make, sometimes the higher their divorce rate goes. I have a friend who calls that affluenza.
That is interesting because that's not the typical nuance that you hear every day. Most divorces, so we're taught every day, happen over financial stress.
Yeah, well, poverty comes in the door, love goes out the window.
Financial stress can be because you have too much money. Financial stress can be because you don't have enough money, and it's both ends of that spectrum that I think really get people into that danger zone.
I've got four daughters and two sons, and I know my four daughters cause a lot of financial stress.
Hey, this is just
the
beginning, Chris.
Daughters.
Come on now. Yeah. Supposedly, you got to pay for four weddings, right?
Four weddings and a funeral.
There you go. Now, you have two pages of this kind of question and answer back and forth in your single person's guide to owning real estate and being in a relationship. Anybody out there that's interested in getting the full guide, the helpline number, 888-551-2593. Again, that's the number, 888-551-2593. It's my cell phone. I'll ring my cell phone, leave a message. Sean will call you back and give you all the insight you may need and email you his free pamphlet on this. Also, when we come back, Sean is going to touch on collaborative divorce, and Chris is going to tell us how we can beat out cash offers with
his
financing when we come back. Welcome back, 1700 AM, the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White, in studio with us today, Sean Weber, family law attorney, Brave Weber and Mac.
The love doctor.
And Chris McBeardy, the lending company.
The TLC.
Thank you, gentlemen. So, Sean, tell us a little bit more about this collaborative divorce thing that you're promoting.
Well, collaborative divorce is really a better way to do a divorce than the whole court thing, you know, the litigation thing. I had a law school professor that said that litigation was like a meat grinder. You go in a pig, you come out a sausage.
Everybody that I talk to that goes through that just complains about going to the court day after day, sitting there waiting and just...
Everybody but the attorneys.
It's grueling.
Well, even the attorneys. I mean, if you would just want to get depressed, go over to the family court at 6th and Cedar.
Yeah.
And just hang out in the lobby and watch people. It's really an awful experience, and
DMV.
It's an awful experience, and what we've done with collaborative divorce, it's a new principle. It originated in Minnesota with an attorney there. But the idea is two attorneys work for parties. They sign an agreement with the parties that says they're never going to cross the threshold of the courtroom. Okay, they're never going to go to court. If they do go to court,
it sounds nice.
It is nice. And if the parties decide they're going to go to court, then the attorneys drop out of the case. So there's an incentive to stay in the process.
And that's nice, because if you pre-agree like that, it's not this whole, well, if we don't agree, I'm going to take you to court.
Correct. And it takes the whole posturing out. For me, it's a much better experience, because I don't have to go to these meetings and posture. I'm always worried in litigation cases.
Hey, one thing, the most important thing we're not talking about here is the huge money savings involved.
Correct. It's a big deal. Now, collaborative isn't necessarily divorce on the cheap, because you do have the two attorneys still working on the case.
Right.
But you're not preparing for litigation. You're not doing all that nasty discovery stuff. So that does reduce the cost a little bit. And then the emotional cost is greatly reduced.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a case this morning where the parties were sitting across the table, and we had a very productive meeting. We settled the case. And the wife, the divorcing wife, turned to the husband, my client, and just with tears in her eyes, thanked him for being respectful towards her. And for making this a process that was better for her kids. And, you know, that gave me a kind of a warm fuzzy.
Man, that just makes you scratch your head, though, doesn't it? You know?
Yeah. You know, it doesn't have to be this ugly battle. You can have a divorce that's respectful, that's mutual. And the other thing that's great about collaborative divorce is we bring in other professionals to work on a team.
Yeah, who else is there?
Well, you can have divorce coaches, which are basically mental health professionals that are experienced in divorce cases and help the parties with the emotions of the divorce. You know, 90% of the work that I do is emotional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people put like an emotional value maybe on the house or on their pension or something like that.
The family.
The kids. What are we going to do with the kids? It's a big deal. You can also have a child specialist who's just a mental health professional for the kids and can help with that. And then you can also have a financial specialist be a part of the case, which is a really invaluable tool because, number one, I am not a financial analyst. I give bad financial advice because I'm not qualified to do it. I'm an attorney. But if I can have this financial person in the room to help the parties plan, we can do things in a marital settlement agreement that is so much better than what you would ever end up with court, because we got more flexibility because the parties can agree.
That's hugely important, because there could be certain tax implications to, you know, settling the financial assets. Either way, whether it be a home, whether it be investment property, whether it be 401ks, IRAs, retirement assets.
Exactly. Well, for instance, spousal support is a deductible expense to the support payer and it's taxable to the support recipient. Well, we can play with the spousal support to actually create wealth for the community, for the family, because the support recipient's usually taxed at a lower rate than the support payer. And so it's like you're making money for the parties without doing anything other than just passing money back and forth. It's a savings for the payer and it's a savings for the recipient.
That's interesting.
The collaborative divorce sounds more like a strategic divorce.
Yeah, it really is better.
You know, if you're just tuning in, we're on the line with Sean Weber with Brave Weber and Mack, a love doctor attorney that's really, really knowledgeable in terms of, you know, getting a divorce without actually having to go to court. And we're also here with Chris McBeardy. And one of the things that we talked about was, you know, this commingling of assets and whether or not the real estate that you've acquired during the time frame you've been married, the goalposts between the day you got married and the day you got divorced, and you know what you do with that. And one of the things that was brought up is the fact that if you have a interest-only loan, there may not necessarily be a division of that asset because you didn't actually add to the equity of that property while you were married. And you know that led to a question is, do people still get just these types of loans anymore? I mean,
they're very rare.
Interest-only loans.
Interest-only loans are extremely rare, and there's still a large black mark, you know, black check mark written next to interest-only loans these days. The secondary market doesn't like them. The investors out there don't like to buy them. It's tough to get securities against them, and the reason is because of the stigma that interest-only loans acquired from, you know, what happened in 2006, 7, and 8. Mm-hmm. And the great mortgage, you know, downfall.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Chris McBeardy with The Lending Company. And Chris, you know what? You're very much in the game right now. You're flipping property yourself. You're doing a lot of refinances. In fact, we talked a little bit about this 0.5% down FHA loan. That's 0.5%. And how that's changing the FHA buyer to be more like a cash buyer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, one of the interesting things we've been seeing over the past 6 months that's really culminated into a nightmare for a lot of buyers out there today is they're competing with cash offers or they're competing with conventional offers. And the typical idea is that a lot of people believe that cash offers and conventional offers are stronger offers than FHA or VA. So we're trying to create a process that makes it easier for people to compete with cash offers and conventional offers.
Yeah, and that's why you're here. We're going to talk about that process so we can actually nail down how we can take an FHA buyer and give them the edge where they may be able to be the one who gets that house over the all-cash investor, per se.
That's right.
So what are some of the techniques that you're advising your clients to do?
Well, some of the real basics are, first and foremost, get your paperwork in to a professional. You know, give me a call. Let's get your paperwork in. Let's run you through underwriting as if you had a property, but let's just put the application, your paperwork, all your qualifications in, get it all signed off, get you fully approved, sans a property. That pretty much makes you a cash buyer right there.
Well, that was a really important point you mentioned. You kind of breezed over it. Get it underwritten.
Yes.
That's the crucial step right there, and what I'm finding, it actually works versus not working. Well, getting a full DU approval without a property is as close as you're going to get to having a cash buyer.
Yeah, the full DU underwriting approval, meaning you actually worked with an FHA buyer recently where when you talked to the agent, you were trying to convince that agent to take the offer that your FHA buyer had made. Your case was, you know, we're not just pre-approved, we're DU underwritten. And
well,
you actually have
this is actually taking that a step further, guys. This is actually going beyond the DU. This is actually submitting it to a live body. You know, those people aren't just rubber stamps. They're there for checks and balances. They're there to try and sniff out anything they can in the file that's going to make it so that a security can't be issued against that loan on the secondary market. So an underwriter is actually going to review your file. We're actually going to approve it with everything checked off. Income, assets, cash to close, down payment, you name it. Everything except for the property.
Well, that's a great service, is there are a lot of cash buyers out there that are beating those that have loans. And really what I found is a lot of lenders are reluctant to run a buyer through the process completely until they have a property. And that's putting them at a great disadvantage. So that's great news to hear that you guys are willing to do that.
I think you're going to see that culture change here pretty quick, because it's not that it's become a seller's market. It's that it's become a market of buyers competing with buyers. There's been a lot of people sitting on the fence waiting to buy. Well, guess what? A lot of people are coming off the fence. The inventory's not there. Buyers are competing with buyers. It's my job to make your offer stronger than everybody else's, even some of those cash offers.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it seems like the government's doing a lot to help the first-time buyer. And when we say first-time buyer, we mean to say someone who hasn't purchased a home in 2 years. You can have purchased a home prior to 2 years and still classify as a first-time buyer. And this 0.5% down FHA loan, tell us a little bit about that, because that's really changing the FHA landscape. Because when someone makes an offer with FHA, a lot of times what they do is, say, they make an offer for a $300,000 house, and they want to write the offer for, say, $310,000, have the seller, you know, credit them $10,000, and they risk the appraisal when they do this. I don't know if this is too complicated to talk about over the, or, you know, just now, but when you start pushing the appraisal issue, then, you know, the seller thinks, well, geez, I'll take this all cash offer over here, which could likely be a shorter term, right? They want to close in 15 days versus 45 or something like that. So the first thing that we talked about in terms of making your FHA or conventional offer compete with the cash offer was get fully approved. Chris, what is the second step?
I think the second step is, after you're fully approved and we present that offer, some of the things we can do is we can shorten the typical term of escrow. And we're doing this every day right now at the lending company. Typical escrow around San Diego County, and correct me if I'm wrong, guys, it's, what, 30 to 45 days. That's what people are asking
for.
At
best, right?
Yeah, and a lot of times you see 30-day escrows, and you're counting on that thing being extended. It happens a lot. We're seeing it all the time. Well, guess what? You get fully approved, you find that dream house, you can write a 21-day or less escrow. You can do it. You can absolutely do it. And that is huge for some investors. And then another large factor, and this is really something, this is the mojo factor that we were talking about earlier.
Let me stop you there, because we definitely want to get into the mojo when we come back.
Okay.
We're gonna go through the other topics that you have outlined that specifically talk about how you can make your offer look like a cash offer, and we're gonna talk about mojo, that unknown quantifiable advantage that really puts you over the edge, when we come back. Welcome back to ESPN 1700. We are on the line with Sean Weber with Brave Weber and Mack, attorney at law, the love doctor, the expert in collaborative divorce, and we're here with Chris McBeardy with the lending company. Chris, we've known each other for like 10 years, and you know, you mentioned earlier, if you've got an interest rate higher than 3.875, you're recommending that people get that evaluated in terms of whether or not it's good to refinance right now.
Absolutely, until you look at it strategically and compare an apple to an apple and figure out what you might or might not be able to save over time, you won't know.
Before we cut to break, we talked about the, well, seven topics that make your offer look more like a cash offer. The first one was get fully approved, and we're not talking about a DU approval. We're actually talking about really underwritten. The second thing is you can write a shorter escrow because of the fact that now you're really approved, so now you're more like these all-cash offers. And the third thing that we're talking about here is the real estate mojo. Now, what is that?
The mojo is important. That's the human side of what we do. And a lot of people, they just assume that we're realtors and loan officers, and, you know, they just don't assume that maybe we're just business machines. Well, the reality is we do what we do for a reason. We like it. We like working with the people. We enjoy the people. We specifically enjoy certain parts of our business. I really like first-time homebuyers. That's one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is we help people write a cover letter about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it important to move into this house? Is it that your son has become a certain age and needs to be in a better school district?
Mm-hmm.
Is it that your mom or your parents or elderly family lives down the street? You mm-hmm. want to be closer to them?
Mm-hmm.
These things matter. I'm an investor. I've received these letters. I've chosen these letters over cash mm-hmm. offers before mm-hmm. because it makes sense.
The letters are back, folks. You know, when the market was as hot as it was and it became a seller's market, home buyers will sit down. It's a great investment, maybe 20 minutes out of your day, and write out why you like the property and tell your story to that homeowner. When you submit that offer, make sure you include that letter, because you know, there's a lot of investors out there. We have nothing against the investors out there, but if you're a primary home buyer, you have advantages and you have cards in your hand that you can play that make a huge difference. I have seen people sell houses to a buyer for less money because of the fact that they liked that buyer. And they said, you know what? I've owned this house for 20 years. I decide who I sell it to. That doesn't make a lot of sense to the people out there that are analytical about selling their property. And we don't want to cross a gray area here about what we're talking about in fair lending and so on, the practices about purchasing property. But when it comes to the mojo, the unquantifiable factor of finding a buyer that it has, you know, sits down for 20 minutes and writes out a letter and accompanies that letter with that offer, can actually save you thousands of dollars.
So many offers, just to touch on some of the points that we've talked about thus far. So many offers I see today in this day and age, not a cover letter, no cover letter whatsoever. Not even a letter in the email from the realtor explaining what's going on. It's just, here's an offer, take it, look at it, let us know if it works for you. If not, you know, that's life. No follow-up phone call.
That works in a market where there's tons of inventory and there's no buyers out there.
Right.
Right? Now, when you're competing and you hear it, there's 10, 15 offers on properties and such like that. In fact, a lot of properties are not hitting the market right now. A lot of them, you know, people find these short sales. They've got buyers in their back pocket. They put a sign in the front yard. Boom, you get a buyer call, and it's in escrow before it's actually hitting the multiple. So there's a lot of things going on right now. And this mojo that you're talking about can actually put your property on the top. So there's actually seven things to this list. And the other, so we talked about getting fully approved, shorten the escrow term because of the approval, writing that mojo letter. The fourth thing is this guaranteed close. Chris, tell us a little bit about the guaranteed close.
Yeah, so provided we've been able to approve your buyer and provided we've been able to go through the underwriting process, that means that you're basically walking around with a check. My approval letter is more like a check and more like a cash buyer than anyone else's in this marketplace because we're not doing some computer automated model. We're going through the full process. So the guaranteed close is something that we can work with you guys that when you write the offer on behalf of that buyer, you can put in there, we guarantee to close in 21 days or less, or we, as in myself and my mortgage company, will put our money where our mouth is. We will pay a per diem to that seller for every day we go past 21 days.
If you're just tuning in right now, you're listening to Chris McBearty from The Lending Company, and we've got seven topics here to make your offer look like a cash offer, to give you the advantage so that homeowner chooses your property. The hotline here to get the seven topics, because we're not going to get to them all today, is 888-551-2593. Call me, leave a message. I'll get you in touch with Chris. Again, the number is 888-551-2593. So, you know, we talked a little bit about this 0.5% down FHA loan. This is a game changer for a lot of the buyers out there, and the reason why I believe it's a game changer is because traditional FHA is 3% down. 3.5% down, okay? Which causes some problems when people try to buy properties for no money down, meaning they write offers over asking the seller to compensate the buyer in the transaction, essentially making it it's like 100% financing. But the issue there is that now we may have an appraisal issue. And when you're competing with, say, an all-cash, full-price offer, you're probably going to get beat out there. So, you know, this 0.5% down may give you an advantage. I mean, if you buy a property for $400,000, we're only talking about $2,000 down.
And there's no extra compensation from the seller to make it happen.
Exactly.
This is sponsored by the National Home Buyers Fund via the California Home Buyers Fund. It's called a CHF Access Loan. The technical term is CHF Access Platinum. There's very few lenders in California that have the ability to lend on this program, and it is absolutely an FHA loan that has no difference from any other FHA loan other than a 3% grant is given to the buyer from the National Home Buyers Fund to purchase a home. There's no repayment. It's not like many of the city bond programs where you have to live there for a certain amount of years. There's no second mortgage. There's none of that.
Say that one more time. Go through the whole scenario one more time. That sounds too good to be true.
Yeah. It is what it is. It is a 0.5% down FHA loan.
The state is making up the other 3%? Is that what's happening?
The National Home Buyers Fund is a nonprofit national fund that grants 3%. Now, mind you, let's say if there is a catch, the catch would be that on occasion they run out of money, obviously.
Well, you know, it seems like in a lot of times, you know, the devil's in the details here. So, you know, a lot of times I hear about these programs and I think, yeah, you know, a lot of smoke, no fire.
Right.
Meaning, you know, they've got this great program, it's going to save all these people, and no one gets the deal.
Right.
Because the qualifications are like, you got to, you know, you're trying to win the teddy bear at the fair. It's basically impossible to get it. Right?
That's not the case here.
You're seeing this. This is actually happening.
Yeah, this is actually happening. Now, let's talk about some of the restrictions. You've got to be within 115% of the county median income. But to give you an example of what that is, for a family of four living in San Diego County, that's still over $100,000.
So if I make $100,000 or less, and I'm a family of four in San Diego County, I qualify.
You qualify. We are going to underwrite this loan a little bit stricter, meaning sub 640 credit scores better have some compensating factors. We, in many cases on FHA loans, on debt-to-income ratios, on a regular 3.5% down FHA loan, a lot of times we'll stretch the qualifications and the ratios. On this particular loan, we're not stretching.
Well, you know, I mean, obviously there's underwriting processes that take place in order to get people approved, right? And there's no way we can go over them, all of them, over the phone or right now.
Too many to talk about,
So if you're interested in finding out more about this and you want to talk to Chris McBearty about this, call us at 888-551-2593. That's the number, 888-551-2593. I wanted to get to this rescue loans. What is this all about?
This is a huge topic today. We are seeing a lot of incapable lenders out there that go into escrow with their clients and are just flat out unable to close. They get into the red zone and they can't take it over the goal line. We are rescuing a lot of deals right now at the lending company. For example, a lot of companies out there, my competitors, won't do a credit score below 640. That's just one example. Some won't do a flip property with a credit score below 700. We love this stuff. If you're having troubles getting your financing right now and you're in escrow, give me a call. We can help you.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris. I really appreciate the input on that. If you guys are interested in finding out a little bit more about what we're talking about, give us a call at 888-551-2593. Leave a message, 888-551-2593. Thank you so much, Sean Weber, the Love Doctor, in the house today, talking about collaborative divorce.
You're welcome.
Thank you for coming on the show. And thank you for coming on the show, Chris McBearty.
Anytime, sir.
Great.
Until next week.
Until next week. We'll see you then.